Chapter 6, Find What's Hiding. Just stop and think for a moment what your high school experience was like. Were you in sports or clubs? What extracurriculars were your favorite? How were your grades? Did you have a solid group of friends? How'd you get along with your parents? What kinds of things did you do that they, your parents, didn't know about? Were you happy? If yes, what kinds of things were what contributed to your happiness? If no, why? What was going on? One of the things that I notice all the time is how parents of teens and young adults are shocked by their kids' behaviors. Mostly the not so awesome ones. And when I ask them about their high school experiences, the parents weren't all angels either. Many of them got in some lightweight trouble as a teen and or young adult, yet are shocked to discover their own kid lied about where they were or who they were with, or got caught drinking or smoking pot, or picked a fight with their parents and are generally pissy most of the time. Now, in no way am I saying cutting should be normalized like some of the other negative behaviors one might expect from a teen and young adult. Truly. I am just saying take some time to try to remember how hard it was being that age and what it might be like to be a teenager now in this day and age. These kids are stressed out. I had no idea that so much of my job would be teaching people to lighten up and have some fun. I love that. But I thought it would be reining them in more, not opening them up as much as I do. Whether it be age differences, regional differences, and/or other factors I'll get into, it appears this generation of young adults has more opportunity, access, comforts, and a whole lot more worries. The differences in generations aren't as important, I don't think, unless we don't understand the difference in stressors of the generations. And if your kid is cutting, something is definitely stressing your kid out past the point where they are equipped to handle it. Since not disclosing personal information to parents is somewhat of a teen and 20s hallmark of any generation, I'm going to tell you now there's stuff you don't know. Let's get into that so you can start to make educated guesses on what it might be. Then you can sit down and ask your kid what's up with them. If they won't talk to you, you can guess and tell the clinician they will soon see. More on that later. For now, there are many areas of stress to consider with today's kids. There are several stressors that I've discussed with teens and young adults over the last 15 years that their parents initially did not know about or consider when I started working with them. It's important to identify the factors that are causing distress in your kid's life so we can figure out how to reduce their intensity and manage the problems. The other reasons I want you to consider each of these stressors, even the ones you're certain have nothing to do with your kid, are because I want you to practice finding your empathy. Imagine what it might be like for you if you were them. Your near adult kid, if that stressor was their struggle. Then, after you've found empathy for your kid inside each of these imagined stressful situations, I want you to imagine talking to your kid about what they're going through. In this imagined interaction, I want you to imagine listening without talking, waiting to talk, or offering problem-solving advice. Just listen to what your kid is telling you. Even if what they're saying makes you anxious, just take 3 deep breaths, don't interrupt, and keep listening. after you've practiced this a bit, the pro move, as I call it, what only the really emotionally intelligent participants can do is to imagine and actually feel the gratitude that comes from knowing you have cultivated a connection and openness with your near adult child, that they are the one in 1,000 of that age group that really talks to their parents. Again, try this exercise with each of the following stressors. Grades. If your kids' grades have tanked recently or are starting to slip, there may be a few things to explain what's going on here. Freshman year's a bitch. Whether it be the first year of high school or the first year of college, I see a ton of struggling from kids who previously seemed fine. Transitions are difficult for any of us, but both freshman years happen during biological, hormonal, and neurophysiological changes too. Puberty is in progress, and the prefrontal cortex is not yet fully formed, which means the regulating emotion and processing information areas are in the trial and error phase, and acting reactively or impulsively is prevalent. These biological changes of the human animal are to be considered when evaluating all these potential stressors, but especially in respect to grades and anxiety caused by the newness, which are hallmarks of the freshman years. Often kids that were smart enough to skate by in junior high or middle school find that proper study habits are now a necessity in high school, and they haven't developed any. Or maybe they found the academics in high school a breeze, and now they've entered college with very little discipline and/or time management skills, and they're on their own now. It's hard to know what's going on, meaning, is it an emotional issue or something else? This time period is often where kids get some testing at school or a neuropsychological evaluation to assess whether the student has some learning differences and/or emotional factors that negatively affect grades. I see a lot of UC Berkeley first years come in having been valedictorian of their small high school and find that their new pond is full of former big fish just like them. It blows their minds. It's in these kinds of instances where I see an influx of stimulants being prescribed to help the student focus. And I would just strongly advise that you not put your kid on any form of speed without a neuropsych battery, with someone with experience who's not afraid to say no to you. Long-term stimulant use by people who do not have ADHD, ADD, can cause serious problems down the road. It seems, too, that despite the fact that a rule-out of an anxiety disorder is required to give an ADHD, ADD diagnosis, professionals are handing out stimulants like candy, especially to privileged families of historically high-functioning young adults. I've seen that lead to lots more messes that need cleaning up down the road. Tolerance, addiction, selling or giving it away, manic episodes, and kids just not believing they have capabilities to be successful without it long after they have needed it, if they ever did. The other stressor I see around grades is perfectionism. So many young adults today have forgotten that a B is above average. Literally. Bs are more often viewed by this age group now as might as well have failed. They're obviously getting messages from somewhere that it's A's or nothing. And they think about their grades constantly, which is both caused by and causing anxiety. Even if you think, not my kid, because their grades have been mediocre for a while, maybe forever, Check in on what their actual capabilities are by getting an assessment. One of the major coping tactics used by young adults who believe it's an A or nothing is not trying before they can fail. Yep. If a kid was thought of and or called smart when they were younger, they often perceive that any task that requires any amount of effort threatens their view of themselves as smart, because smart people don't struggle, right? This tendency to give up without trying is more prevalent in females. There is a fascinating TED Talk by Reshma Sujani about teaching girls bravery over perfection. Of course, there's nothing wrong with doing one's best and striving for excellence and achievement, but sometimes setting the bar too high can be so overwhelming to a young adult, well, in fact, anyone, that it causes paralysis. The kid doesn't have a clue where to start, so they don't. In cases like that, the only effective thing may be to lower the bar, perhaps even to below their former or believed capabilities, to a place the student feels confident in their capabilities, and then build up from there at a slow but steady pace. There is more to life than grades. However, this treatment strategy often leads to optimal achievement of the student, whatever that is for them. Don't get me wrong. I think most kids ought to be afraid to come home with D's and F's. But a C every once in a while isn't going to keep them out of a good college. And if they do get a lower grade than you and they believe they are capable of, start with discussing why and maybe think about getting them assessed before assuming it's laziness. Note: I don't believe in laziness as it is widely thought of and used. I believe that what we call laziness is a behavior that results from one of two unmanaged emotions. Can you guess which ones? The first is fear, the paralysis that comes with overwhelm. I don't know where to start, so I won't. And the second is anger, which we'll get into later, which comes out as an F you, I'm not doing that. The lazy person may not be able to define which one it is, or even that it's emotionally driven. And lazy ends the exploration of that before it even begins. Social. This one might have been mentioned first because it's debatable which is more important to teens and young adults, grades or friends. There are few things that'll knock a kid down faster and lower into a funk than shit going down with friends at school. This probably seems obvious to you, but I have actually been on the phone with a worried dad that said to me, I mean, it actually seems like the teen cares more about hanging out with her friends than getting good grades. Well, duh. Friends are everything in high school, and they have a huge impact on college life and beyond. Strong positive connections with people are now being linked to life expectancy, optimal cognitive functioning, less illness, and an increase in quality of life. Now, I think there's a lot of back and forth high drama, and they're friends, and now they're not. And if you agree with that, I strongly suggest you keep that to yourself, or your kid will never again tell you another problem they have with a peer. Remember your validation statements. Just ignore them or kill them with kindness is not a validation statement. Remember, you don't have to agree. You just need to meet them where they are and continue to listen. That sucks, or that doesn't sound very kind, will work. You may even attempt to guess at their feelings in a validation statement, like, seems like you're angry about that. But beware the guess that misses the mark or hits the mark while they're not ready for that truth. It could backfire. Don't push it. Just regroup with something like, okay, well, how do you feel about it? No biggie. Back to listening. Because along with what seems to you like nonsense and drama, you may pick up some little tidbit that tips you off to some real distress your kid is experiencing. And males, even those who now identify as male, are socialized to bottle up most negative feelings besides anger and need to be encouraged to talk about their feelings around socializing. Their distress may present differently, like escaping into video games, some with others online. And if you show some genuine interest in the game, the thing that is important to them, and you get into open conversation, you may again pick up some clues as to the interpersonal conflict that's affecting them negatively. You'd be surprised how much relationship troubles affect males too. And every young adult experiences intense sadness when a romantic relationship ends. So by the time that happens, you want to have established some level of open communication because your kid is probably experiencing a heartbreak that is so real and intense for them that that's where other problems they might be having can all culminate into a crisis. Self-harm and breakups go hand in hand for young people. Cutting may be more prevalent in females and those who identify as female, but self-harm is as common in males. It may not be cutting, but more often presents as fighting, video games, dropping grades, and withdrawal from friends and extracurricular activities. Even though you may not have considered the romantic relationship as important or healthy, you may even be relieved it's over. You do want to validate them and talk to your kid about how they are experiencing it and what negative emotions they can identify. Sadness, regret, anger, hopelessness, etc. A willingness to actively listen to your kid may reveal to you that they are being bullied at school. As you probably know, bullying is no longer limited to boys beating up other boys and stealing their lunch money. The varied forms and levels of bullying that go on for these kids is alarming. Physical fights do still go on and are not limited to one gender, or any gender for that matter. Fighting can be groups or several on one or one on one. The fighting can be driven by many different factors: gender, lack of gender, race, sexual orientation or fluidity, or physical learning cognitive differences. Cyberbullying is the biggest difference in the bullying that goes on with younger generations than our own. The bullying that goes on online actually blows my mind. The psychological distance provided by typing onto a screen has allowed groups of bullies to write heinous things that they would otherwise never have the gall to say to that person's face. I think this is a kind of coward culture that is hurting lots and lots of kids of all ages. As a parent, the most insidious part is that it all goes on behind closed doors. Parents are often shocked to find out how their kids are using the internet, posting party pics on Instagram with bottles of booze in plain sight and their kid obviously wasted. Finstagram, which are fake Instagram accounts where, often college, students post more intimate things, including, but not limited to, how much they are struggling with suicidal inclinations in kind of a emo glorification of mental health diagnoses and struggles. Sending or receiving of dick pics. Sending or receiving nude photos, which, if under 18, can be considered child pornography. Sending or receiving hate speech. sending or receiving a public post instructing another student to just kill yourself. Parents, please pay attention. These are not one-offs. This is rampant. And I'd be more surprised if your kid did not have one of these happen than if they said they did. But they often don't tell their parents. They tell me. Another set of eyes on your kid will help supplement the attempts you make for more communication with your kid about their friend group. Non-majority. There are still cliques of sorts in high school, college, and beyond. The names or types have changed, along with what they consider cool. But it's only really important to know the haves and the have-nots are still in effect. What parents of multiple generations have told their kids of all ages is, just be yourself. Yes, I 100% agree. I agree that any human's lifelong challenge, work, and practice is to learn to take an honest look at themselves, accept their strengths and weaknesses alike, practice liking, loving, and taking good care of themselves through healthy choices and compassion for mistakes, and expand and grow. Yes, 100%. The problem comes with the reality that we are all unique in who we are, which, ironically, makes us all alike. But that's not really how the world works, is it? There are groups of people of all ages who are not part of majority groups. And when you're not part of a majority group, you have challenges the majority doesn't have. Now times 1,000, if you're still developing as a human aged 11 to 26, let's say. Your female kid has to deal with the negative feelings she experiences due to sexism. She may experience fear of rape and sexual assault every day and has likely been sexually assaulted at school multiple times. She may be called on less in the classroom and feel frustrated by that. She probably doesn't like her body and is engaged in disordered eating on multiple occasions. And yes, she most likely has at least tried cutting to cope with all these stressors. Your kid may be hiding from you that they're queer. Have you ever suspected your kid might be gay? Would that be okay with you? They may not identify with assignments given at their birth, like their sex, gender, or name. They have to deal with the stress of school and probably fear of homophobic threats, physical, verbal, and on the internet. Your kid may be very, very isolated, which is always a red flag and makes them feel lonely and maybe self-loathing. They may be cutting, or they may think about suicide. Or they may wonder if you or others will still love them if they just be themselves. If your kid is a person of color and you are a person of color, you already know that institutional racism is a stressor that white people will never experience. Does your kid talk to you about the hate speech they experience at school or online? Your kid may be toughing it out alone and need to talk. Would you be okay with sending them to therapy? How about with a white therapist? More about this later, but you already know. Whoa, choose wisely. And if you were born in another country and your kid was born here, what differences are you prepared to tolerate in them that don't mean to you you're losing them? Your kid may feel anxiety and shame about being between cultural groups and not being blank enough. Are you okay with your kid having friends of another race? Your kid with physical differences or cognitive or developmental differences is probably struggling with bullying and degradation at school, and you probably actively worry about that. What you may not know is that your teen or young adult thinks about sex too. How do you talk to them about their sexuality? Has a caregiver or teacher suggested independent living? Are there potential benefits to your kids' growth to living on their own? Even though your heart rate just skyrocketed reading that. And of course, there are so many ways these kids and stressors intersect. If you are straight and white, please think about that for a minute. If you are male and you were born here, please think about that for a minute. There are many other stressors specific to varying circumstances. Chronic illness, adoption, parents of a different race or culture, to name a few. A lot of times, the more of these non-majority boxes you tick, the more the compounded anxiety, depression, and anger. Anger. I have found in my 15 years of treating people, specifically young people who self-harm, that the number one factor that unifies all the ways they hurt themselves and all the different stress factors among all the unique kids is ineffective management of their experience of anger. You may find this surprising since so far throughout this book, I've been referring to anxiety and depression as the emotions leading to cutting. Let me get into that here. Anxiety is almost always a factor when someone is cutting themselves. I have found that few things spike anxiety like stuffed anger. I have had participants I work with come in with chronic self-harm behaviors and cutting, and frequent and debilitating panic attacks. They may have been cutting on and off for a while. Maybe they haven't cut themselves in years, or maybe they still cut themselves weekly. But what brings them through my door for the first time are the panic attacks. They're having them at school, work, home. They're fearing one coming on, even when they're not having them. We've tracked the timing, the situation or situations, the patterns of onset of the panic attack, and after years of seeing this, we almost always uncover buried rage, like years-long stuffed anger. They've been so afraid of the anger, they've chronically avoided dealing with it, and now it inevitably erupts from inside them. They even resist my initial theory that it may be related to anger. Mind you, they're desperate to stop having panic attacks. They literally think they will die during a panic attack, come in begging for help, yet immediately dismiss the idea that anger may play a role. They don't always even know they're doing that. It's just so ingrained in them, for one reason or another, to deny their experience of anger. I'm telling you, time and time again, we do some really tough anger work, which requires a lot of unlearning and a shit ton of courage on their part. And many never have another panic attack again. And some do when they stuff their anger again. Then they understand that there is some choice and control in their management of both anger and anxiety. So, with cutting, even without the panic attacks, there's a relationship between anxiety and anger and engaging in self-harming behaviors. We see the unhealthy behaviors decrease as the new healthy tools are understood, taught, and practiced. Depression can often work the same way with kids or just people that cut. I think of anxiety and depression as basically two sides of the same coin. And there is so much attention paid by MDs in treating depression that I think very often the anxiety that almost always fuels or is a factor in depression is missed. I talk about this with my participants and let them know there is indeed a difference between clinical depression and what I call anxiety burnout. It's worth noting that anxiety is an emotion under the umbrella of fear. But depression is not an emotional experience. It's a diagnosis, a pathological condition. Most people using the word depression interchangeably with sadness, which is mostly a naturally occurring emotional, Most people use the word depression interchangeably with sadness, which is mostly a naturally occurring emotional experience. People say, I was feeling a little depressed today, until I make this point and they tweak the language. People have been so conditioned to look at depression as common and normal instead of a treatable diagnosis that they forget that sometimes they feel sad. And that's okay. Anxiety burnout is the paralysis that comes from overwhelm. Remember before when I said, I don't believe in laziness? That laziness is either the result of strong feelings of fear or anger. Well, if someone's in bed all the time, we automatically think they might be depressed, right? But what I see just as often is more of a hiding from the world. The old, I don't know where to start, so I won't, which many people rationalize into, I can't, or there's no point anyway. So it gets mistaken for depression instead of anxiety. Also, have you ever heard the saying, depression is anger turned inward? Turns out there's some truth to that. And again, in the case of someone being lazy and staying in bed all the time, It may be overwhelm, but it could also be the digging the heels in of anger. Fuck you, I'm not doing that. Or life is stupid and a waste. Or It may be overwhelm, but it could also be the digging the heels in of anger. Fuck you, I'm not doing that. Or life is stupid and a waste. Or everything I do amounts to nothing. Again, this looks like what we call depression, and it may well be. But when I've done the anger work with folks that cut and maybe also stay in bed or have panic attacks or many other symptoms and problems, we find so much there. So why are people so afraid of anger? It's just an emotion like any other emotion. Anger is the emotion that alerts us that our boundaries are being crossed or violated. So it's important to learn how to identify when we feel anger. Anger can help us stay emotionally and even physically safe. I think people worry feeling and naming anger will lead to them blowing up uncontrollably and looking like an asshole. Funny thing is, the complete opposite is true. Naming anger validates our emotional experience and gives us the chance to learn tools for effectively managing anger and choosing how we want to handle our anger. It's the lack of awareness of anger and denial of its existence that lead to outbursts and tantrums and choices that bite us in the ass later and cause shame. Without the anger work, I seriously have no idea how anyone who cuts themselves stops. I haven't ever seen that happen. Anger work does take a bit, though. It's a process you really don't want to rush. Long gone are the days where psychologists thought family therapy with padded bats was a healthy move. The general thought these days is that pushing someone into intense bursts of anger on purpose is harmful and often leads to more uncontrolled anger. So we don't poke the bear in my office. We take it at a pace that is uncomfortable and challenging, yet tolerable, sometimes even slower than that. In chapter eight, we'll get you some tools for handling that ride. But first, let's tackle this question of to medicate or not to medicate in chapter seven. Okay, yeah, I'm done. Jesus.
Yeah, but that's awesome. We got a ton done. Way to go.
Sweet. So